Hello, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you most want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you most want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org, and we're funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955, one of the finest writers' organizations in the country, I can easily say. If you want to learn more about the PNWA, as well as their wonderful yearly writers' conference, you can go to pnwa.org. Let's see, November's and early December, somewhat quiet month for me. It'll be teaching a three-part class at East West Books in Ravenna in Seattle, Writing as a Spiritual Practice. You can go to all three or just individually drop in on any one of them. It's up to you. You can find out about that at either eastwestbooks.com or williamknauer.com if you want to look up that, or maybe look into having me come speak to your writer's organization, to your writing club, or if you want to work with me individually. I do love to talk to people about writing and their lives. And, of course, if you ever need a little dose of inspiration to remind you why writing is worth it, why creating anything is worth it, why living is worth it, pick up a copy of Write Within Yourself, an author's companion to keep by your bedside when your writer's soul needs feeding. So speaking of writers, William Faulkner famously said, one of his novels, the past isn't dead, it's not even past. I wonder, though, I haven't asked her, but I suspect our current guest, today's guest, Christina McMorris, might agree with Faulkner on that. I first interviewed Christina, I think it was about 2 or 3 years ago, when she released her first novel, Letters from Home, which dealt, it was a story which she pulled in part from her own family history and went back to World War II. And since then, she has published 3 full-length novels, all dealing in one way or another with that time, including her most recent, which is published today, November 26th. The Pieces We Keep also deals in part, in a most interesting way, with that period of time, with World War II. But the past is fertile ground for us, for some of us at least, and it seems to be for Christina, but I wonder why. I wonder why she keeps returning to that time and place. Well, the easiest way to find out is to ask her, which is just what I'm going to do right now. Christina, welcome to the show.
Hi there. Hi, thank you so much. What a lovely introduction.
It was my pleasure, Christina. So, well, first of all, congratulations. Today, the book was released, and right away people are snatching it up. You've already got a studio interested. Is this all true?
It is. It's been a really, really, it's one of those days you chalk up as an author that you think, I've got to remember this moment and this day, because there are enough hard days as I stare at that blinking, taunting cursor for 500 pages that you think, why am I doing this? And then you have a moment like today. And yes, there's been some film interest already today, and just heard from my editor just a few hours ago, we went back to press. So that's wow. A good way to kick off a release day.
That's awesome. So it's off to a good start. You know, it's really true. You know, as the writer, it's good to have days like this when the thing finally gets out and takes flight. But you better enjoy to some degree staring at that blinking cursor, because that is 99% of your time, isn't it?
It's so true. And I am a person I'm the writer who hates to write. It's kind of the joke in our house. Because I hate writing a first draft, but I love to revise. I love to polish and to go back and play with the sentences and the words and obsess, you know, over a sentence. So I think that's the only reason I love to stick with it, because I
now,
can't
wait
for that
minute.
Second stage.
It's so interesting. Everybody is so different, Christina. Okay, so why do you hate the first draft? What is it that is so odious? I love first drafts. I'm certain this is going to be the easy one. I fool myself that way every time. Why do you hate the first draft?
You know what's funny? Whenever I hear another author that says that, the running joke is that we should pair up, that you should write the first draft and I will polish it, and we could put out about 4 books a year if we weren't really hard and diligent. No, you know, I don't know what it is. You know what I think it is? I think my first novel, Letters from Home, which you mentioned, was it came from such a personal place of being inspired by my grandparents' wartime courtship letters from World War II. And I was so blissfully ignorant at the time that I think I've always been a storyteller, but just didn't know that it was in the form of books until I started writing that book. And for me, I think that there were no critics yet. There were no reviewers. There was no voice in your head telling you that you really didn't know what you were doing. And so it was so easy to write. It's kind of the NaNoWriMo, I think, mentality that you just write with abandon, and you're not judging it, and you're not editing as you go along and criticizing a sentence you wrote 2 seconds ago. And because I do edit heavily as I go, actually, I think that's where it's kind of a slow process, dredging process for me. But once it's on paper, I love to play with it. So I think that's the reason why. After 3 novels and anthologies, you know, you start – it's hard, I think, so many times to block out the world and realize you have an audience that's waiting.
Yes, and that audience can that awareness of the audience can either inspire you or, as you've described, really meddle with the creative process, because the truth is when you're writing, they can't factor into it really. I mean, it's got to be just you and that story.
Yes,
but,
absolutely.
But
yeah,
I imagine you had a contract that you were having to fulfill,
right.
And, you know, an audience that you wanted to continue to have a relationship with.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's that blessing of a curse and curse of being an author that that is on contract. You're so grateful to have a contract, and yet it forces you to sit down every day and treat it like a job, Monday through Friday. You know, I write when the kids are at school. Whether I feel inspired or not, it doesn't really matter. You know, something has got to get on paper so that I have something to work with. I think it was a good thing with this last book, with The Pieces We Keep, because I remember distinctly, I loved the premise. I was so in love with the premise that anytime I told a book club about it, when they asked me what I was working on next, I would give them a premise and I would get chills on my arms. And that to me always says, that's my next book. That's what I have to write.
Yeah.
And I was so excited about it. You know, and it's always such a perfect story in your head before you destroy it by putting it on paper, of course. It's just, jokingly, of course. Is that when I started writing this... Go ahead.
Please go ahead. So it's beautiful in your mind, and then you begin to write it.
Right, and you're so worried that you're going to ruin that perfect picture you had in your head of what you wanted to convey. And I started writing the story, and it's a very complex story. Definitely the most challenging in every aspect book that I've ever written. Multiple timelines instead of just multiple narrators. It had both. It changed timelines every 5 to 6 pages. It had to have some fluidity between the two so it didn't seem abrupt, mystery elements. I mean, so many things in this book that I hadn't done before, that halfway through the book, I distinctly remember telling my husband, I don't think that I can pull this off. I just don't think I can do it. I think it's a train wreck. And he, of course, you know, the husband, he comes to me and says, well, he shrugged and said, maybe this is just one of those projects as an artist that you toss away and start from scratch. And I giggled because I'm like, well, it's a great concept if you have, number one, another great idea behind it, and number two, not on contract and the deadline. So I'm grateful looking back that I had no choice, because I am so proud of this book, and I do think it's my best work to date. So I'm happy.
Well, that is great, and the response has been phenomenal and already, which is gratifying. But I think that, you know, you were right to say that, you know, I coach writers individually and in groups, and that feeling of giving yourself chills, what I believe, you were talking about inspiration. My approach to inspiration and creativity is always this, which is that my mood – some of the listeners may have heard me say, I'm never actually in the mood to write, even though I do it every day. But that, just like that story that you described and how much you loved it, my desire to write actually doesn't go away, and it doesn't change. And once I allow my attention to sink to that place where the writing exists, I'm in the mood to write, and inspiration arrives. Do you find that to be the case? In other words, you have to find that chill again every time you go there. You can't be there permanently as a person.
Right, right, absolutely. But I think so much it's been really important to me with every book. I've always got chills when I think of the premise or tell someone about the premise.
Good.
And for me, I always go back to that on the days that I doubt.
Yes.
I start doubting the story and my ability to tell the story. And then I have to go back to that premise and remember. And even telling a few people, again, who haven't heard it, and getting the chills reminds me, no, I'm on the right track. I do need to stick with this. There is something here.
Absolutely. Because that's your guide. Because these stories, they don't come to you fully formed. You have to find them.
Right.
And,
right.
And you have the chills, and that means you get why it's cool. And your job is to teach other people why it's cool. And that can take time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's important when you get those chills is to think, would I buy this book? And that is really how I decided to write the story I did for The Pieces We Keep versus another story I kind of thought about right beforehand. But I thought, you know, I like that story, but I don't think I'd buy that as a reader. And that was the determining factor. I thought it has to be a book that I would pick up and I would be excited to read if it was written by someone else.
Right. Perfect. That is the perfect way to write a book, I think, because why, you know, because you will never know better what is cool and interesting and exciting and sexy and profound than what you find to be exciting and funny and sexy and profound. So if it moves you, that's your only real clue you ever get. What do you know better than that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, again, we talked about, you know, reviewers and critics. You cannot please everyone. There is no movie out there or art piece out there that everyone loves. And, you know, you'll have a movie that people think is, you know, Inception, for example, I thought was absolutely one of the most brilliant movies I've seen from a writing standpoint, and how they translated what must have been a mess on paper to try to comprehend it and put it on the screen to me visually was amazing. And yet, when I talked to my mother-in-law, they said they were completely lost and they really didn't enjoy it because it was too confusing. And that just goes to show you, it's artwork, really. We saw two different things.
That's right. I remember when I was a waiter, I was waiting on this table, and you know, my personal preference, I grew up in the 80s, I listened to a lot of music then, and there was this guy at the table, and he said, he was talking to the rest of the people at his table that I was serving at that time, and he said, because if there's one song in the world that no one can dislike, it's The Heart of Rock and Roll is the Beaten by Huey Lewis and the News. And I remember hating that song, and I wanted to interject and say, it is possible, sir, and you are looking at, but you know, in his mind, he could not imagine that song was everything to him, you know. But I would also this, that Bob Dylan got booed every night when he was at the peak of his, what now is considered the sort of canon of his work, because he plugged in, booed him every night. We don't think about that. If you're a Bob Dylan fan, you think, oh, he's Bob Dylan, the great Bob Dylan, blah, blah. And he got booed. He had to go out and face boos every night.
It's amazing. And I think I will interject, too, by saying that one of the best lessons for me as a writer has been published and getting feedback and seeing, you know, everything from a one-star to a five-star and everything in between, is that what I've really realized is that and I know you know this, is that the experience that the reader has, it half of that experience, I think, is from the author, and the other half is completely the reader. It has nothing to do with me or another author. And so what they're bringing to the table is their own view, their perspective, their experience, which is what makes them either relate or completely not relate or not like a character or love a character based on something that they have in their own past.
Yeah. It's really true. You don't understand how much you surrender. I mean, because you think about your first book. I know, as I recall from our conversation about that book, it took you a long time to find it, did it not? There was a lot of work to go from those letters to a book.
Yeah, absolutely. The first draft was very easy, of course, because I didn't know what I was doing. And and I thought it was brilliant. And of course, if your mother tells you it's brilliant, then it must be brilliant. And
of course,
you know, right? You need those cheerleaders, and you need the constructive criticism people in your life. You need both, I think, through everything that you do, and especially writing. But the first draft was very simple. Going back and then and learning and catching up and reading so much more, and going to conferences and understanding how to tell the premise of the story better, went through many revisions and many drafts to get there. So yes, absolutely.
And so you spent all this time, and you know how it is when the writer, you're poring over every sentence, maybe, you know, oh, does that one work? Should I take this out?
Right.
All the characters. And then you hand it over And then you understand that, that they're going to do with it what their imagination does and what their lives do. And it's and what you wanted it to be is irrelevant at that point, you know, what the reviewer wants. It's not yours anymore.
Right. Absolutely. And I think that's so true when you're dealing, too, with traditional publishing, with a house that's involved and editors involved and, you know, wanting to change certain words and sorry it's too late, you know. So you do really have to let go. And just for me, I make it a very rare instance that I will go back and reread any of my work. So because I like to picture them wonderful in my head and not pick it apart and let it go.
Well, and a lot of the authors that I interviewed talk about going and doing readings. And I've done this. I had a book come out in May, and I'll go do a reading, and I'll change it. I'll change it as I do the reading if I don't care for it.
I mean, oh, my gosh. I'm going to do that.
Why not?
That's great. You know,
it's for the reading.
That. I love that. And you know, my trick is I don't do readings. Like, it's very, very rare that you'll get me to do a reading. Instead, what I usually do for my author events, and it's kind of my excuse to not have to read my work, is that I usually try to give the audience something that they can't get out of the book. So I'll read letters that my grandfather sent from World War II, you know, or have for Bridge of Scarlet Leaves, because it involved the Japanese-American internment, I had former internees with me on a panel, and we actually got to speak about their experiences. So so I think it makes it a fun experience for the readers, but it also gives me an excuse not to read.
You know, reading, I will say, so I read aloud for mine because they're essays and they're sort of personal essays, and I like to read stuff aloud, so I do it. But I will say this. I do think that authors should think about whether they actually want to read from the work, because it is not always an entertaining experience. It's a very particular thing, and I think you've got to really be up for it and enjoy it and want to do it. And if not, just talk, do like what you've done and find some other way to engage with the audience around the subject of the book.
Right.
Because it's not always a lot of fun to listen to someone read their work. It can be quite a dull experience if they're not into it, if they don't know how to do it, you know?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Or if it goes too long, or if it's not from an excerpt that actually is something that is very intriguing right from the get-go, where you're not laying the foundation for the story.
That's right. That's right. So what do you think? I did that. I gave that little quote by Faulkner at the beginning about the past isn't dead. It's not even past. And your three books have all dealt with the past. And in fact, they've all dealt, at least the three complete novels that you've authored in solo, have dealt in some way or another with World War II. I know that the first one began because of those letters was your parents or your grandparents?
My grandparents,
Grandparents, right. So why did you return to World War II again? What brought you back there?
Yeah, it's a good question because I was a little fearful of being labeled as a World War II author only. And and because there's so much to write about that's rich in history of so many different eras, I've always been drawn also to the 50s and to the 30s. The Great Depression is fascinating to me. It's so funny. I keep going back. I found that I kept going back to World War II because I had a different story to tell. And I knew from the get-go I would not tell another World War II story if it was a cookie cutter, if I didn't have something new to say. And so with Bridge of Scarlet Leaves, you know, it really was a story about, of course, the 200 non-Japanese spouses that lived in the camps voluntarily. Now, that to me was a very different story. I had never heard of that before. And
I hadn't either.
Yeah, it's kind of this obscure detail that I think got hidden somewhere. And people didn't talk about it after the war. And because I'm – sorry about that line coming in. Because I'm half Japanese, because I'm half Japanese and the other side is, you know, Caucasian American, I felt that I had a perspective to offer that maybe a lot of authors didn't, and that is living between those two cultures and what it felt like to not know exactly where to fit in. And so that, to me, was where I felt I could make it personal. The third story, of course, with The Pieces We Keep, it's only because my a friend of mine who does a lot of World War II research had shared that this declassified account of Nazi saboteurs in America in 1942, that they were dropped off literally by U-boat on the East Coast. And
there's an
entire incredible story involving J. Edgar Hoover and his deceptive dealings. There's FDR convening a secret military tribunal and executions that happen quietly. When you uncovered that, I thought, you know, again, I have chills right now. It gave me chills. And And then I ended up combining it with another idea for a second story that my agent had said, you know what, Chris, I think this is all one book. This is not two different books. And that is that about having a young boy. And because I'm a mother of two young boys, my oldest son, when he was a toddler, used to talk about a grandmother who didn't exist. Now, you take that for what it's worth. He would talk about the grandma who used to take care of him. And he is known in our family as an old soul. He has the old soul eyes.
Yeah.
He is like a 60-year-old in a 10-year-old body now. And he used to have severe night terrors for a time. Now, when I heard about a news story of a boy who also had night terrors and he had memories of dying in a plane crash in World War II, of course, I wasn't saying anything about my son having the same experience, but it definitely had a personal interest for me.
Clicked in with you.
Yes, and I thought, you know what? I could combine these two into one story, and what if those memories and those dreams he's having of World War II actually do trace back to those Nazi saboteurs? So that is what it became.
That is such a cool premise. You want to hear a funny story? My oldest son, when he was... very much an old soul. In fact, he was such like an old soul, he didn't enjoy childhood, really, I don't think. He was glad to get out of it. But when he was like 3 years old, he just learned to talk because he was very late to talking. He said to us, my wife and me, very matter-of-factly one day, he said, you know, Mom and Dad, when I was blue dust, I got you guys together because I wanted you guys to be together. That's what he said.
Wow.
I said, I believe you. I didn't know what else to say.
Right.
But that's what I thought of when I started reading your book. I thought about Max talking about when he was blue dust.
Right.
And
absolutely.
And really, the book deals with what does not appear to be logically possible, what our rational minds must reject. But I will tell you, the writer within you has to reject to some degree so much of what because those chills you got, hearing the story were based not on any reality, but just on your belief in something that could be. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes. It's a gut feeling. Absolutely. And I think that's
it's within you.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the same with the story. You know, I mean, so much of this particular story is not about, and I felt I had something to say about that, about faith. And that is faith in everything that you cannot tangibly prove, because we are so, you know, proof-related today and evidence-related, that I love the idea of what faith is, and that being whether you're talking about love or relationships or an afterlife or heaven or you name it, anything that you can't prove, faith ultimately comes down to a choice, right? You either have to, you will never have enough proof on either side, and for those kind of discussions and topics. And so for me, that book really was, you know, a journey that I had gone through previously in my life about what faith is in all different aspects. And it really is about making a choice. So hopefully, you know, the reader will get from the story is that it doesn't matter if you believe in the afterlife or heaven or reincarnation or anything like that. What's important is that understanding that we cannot explain everything that's out there. You know, there's just some things beyond explanation, beyond science, and maybe the answers we'll have someday, but we don't have them. And so that's really what it was personally for me.
Absolutely, and chief among them is love. You cannot prove that you love someone. It can't be done, and yet there is not a stronger impulse. I would say it is the only impulse within human beings that moves us forward is love. And you can't, if I said I loved you, that's proof of nothing, as we all know, right? I could give you flowers. That doesn't mean anything, right? There is no proof of it. There is simply the observation of it. And I think you're absolutely right that particularly in the arts, you've got to have faith. Whenever I coach my students, I say that story is in you and you have no proof that it's valuable other than the thought that you wish to share it. What else do you have?
Yeah.
Nothing. You got nothing. Yeah. You have no book sales. You got, you know, if you've got a contract, that's not proof of anything. That just means you'll get paid, but doesn't mean anyone's going to buy it.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
So you've got to have faith in some level, whatever you call that.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I think especially in something with the arts, and that is a business of the arts, there are there are a million reasons that are logical that tell you this is not going to be worth the time. How many things that could go wrong, how, you know, all the negative that you hear in the industry, so many positives, but, you know, what we people tend to like to focus on the negatives of anything.
Sure.
And you can hear those things, and you want to know at the end, when you type the end, that it was going to be worth sitting down and putting all those hours in and writing 300 to 400, 500 pages. And there is no guarantee. And, of course, like you said, what you have to go on really is to keep coming back to that gut feeling that tells you, no, I've got something here.
Yeah. It's worth it to you. And you certainly, what you definitely do, I was just talking to Andre Dubuis III, who wrote The House of Sand and Fog, plus Townie and just Dirty Love. And he talked about that the process has to be worth it for you. You must value the process so that whether the thing comes to fruition the way you want it to or not, you gain something from that experience, which I'm sure you did writing this, regardless of whether it gets made into a movie or not.
Yeah, I think that's so true, because there is so much that's out of our hands. I mean, the sales, the covers, the publicity and marketing. It's, the 50 Shades of Grey. I mean, who knew that book was going to hit like it did, right? And there will be a million other authors that are frustrated and don't understand, but because so much of it is a lottery and a luck of the draw so often. And so, yes, I agree with you. You have to put that first, because if it's just results-oriented, I think it can be a very, very frustrating business.
Well, it's kind of meaningless in a way. You've got to get something out of the experience that you're going into yourself and tuning into this thing. I mean, just look at it. It gave you chills. And now if it gives someone else chills, isn't that like a magical experience?
Yeah.
That this thing that was in you is now of value to somebody you probably never will meet.
Yeah. Yeah, I have to share with you. This is that I've only shared with my husband so far. I visit with book clubs all the time. It was about a few weeks ago that I Skyped with a club, and one of the women, when she first got on, said, she'd read Bridge of Scarlet Leaves. And what she had said is, which of course every author wants to hear that, I couldn't put it down and I love the story and I love the characters. Of course, such a compliment. And yet what she came back to me stunned me, and she said, reading this book changed how I see the world. And I didn't know what to say to that. And I just got chills again just now, because how can you ask for a better compliment than that? And I just realized I created, it's not just me, of course, all these authors that do this, create these characters in our heads, our stories in our heads. And the fact that you can make fiction change someone's view of the world or other people is really pretty amazing. It's a gift that we're able to share. Yeah.
And I hope you remember that, because the money's great. Maybe the hours are great. I don't know. Everybody's hours are different. I mean, there's all these nice things about being an author. But the chance to do that, to be a sort of teacher in a way about, let me offer you a perspective that I think can help you because it helped me. To me, that's the whole game right there.
Yeah.
I couldn't give it up for anything, I don't think. It's just great. Well, we'll keep that with you, Christina, because that's the fuel that keeps it going. Well, listen, very quickly, we have just about a minute left. Finish this sentence for me. If writing has taught me anything, it's taught me what?
Ooh. It's taught me to observe, to really listen better, and I think writing is observing. It's understanding other people's feelings and their reactions, and the fact that everybody acts the way they do, says what they say, whether good or bad, because it comes from somewhere, because of something they've experienced.
I think that's
so true in everyday life, and you have to understand that as a writer in order to be true to that character.
I like it. I like it, Christina. Thank you so much. Good luck. It doesn't sound like you need it, but good luck with this. I hope I get to see it on the silver screen.
Me too.
Now that I've read it in the paperback form. Good luck. And the next one that comes out, let me know. I'll have you back on, okay?
I would love that. This half hour went by way too fast. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
All right, Christina, good luck. Thanks a lot.
All right, bye-bye.
Well, everybody, look, you can change the book. You really can, honestly. That's not why she wrote that book. She wrote that book to entertain people because she had a story to tell, and yet someone says it changed the way she saw the world. It can happen, by God. If it can happen to her, it can happen to you, too. So write what you love. Write what you care about. Write what gives you chills, and then just see what happens. You really can't go wrong. Until next week, I can't remember who I've got on next week. It'll be somebody good, I'm sure. Until then, go kiss somebody you love. Somebody!